Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark. I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker of the Week, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week, making a return visit, is the nation's premier columnist, George F. Will, who has a new book. It is called American Happiness and Discontents, The Unruly Torrent, 2008 to 2020. Welcome, one and all. George, I want to start with you. I want to talk a little bit about your new book, which is, as always, brimming with insight and wit and lapidary turns of phrase. So one of your trademarks as a columnist is your deep immersion in history, most particularly American history. Sometimes this is a source of, well, at least for your readers, I imagine for you as well, sometimes it's a source of inspiration. And alternatively, it can be, it can offer some perspective on the problems we're facing in the current moment. So I will just give an example from a column that you wrote in April of 2017. It's called America's Dark Home Front During World War I. Quote, Woodrow Wilson imposed and incited extraordinary repressions. Quote, there are citizens of the United States born under other flags who have poured the poison of disloyalty into the very arteries of our national life. Such creatures of passion, disloyalty, and anarchy must be crushed out. They are infinitely malignant, and the hand of our power should close over them. And then, unquote, then you go on to describe some of the really quite horrific repressions that were accepted in this country during World War I. When you're presenting those examples, is it to just be a reminder of progress that things have been, we've lived through some pretty horrific things in our past?
That's part of it. One, that's certainly a didactic reason. Another reason is it's just fun. It's fun to see these things. Let me give you an example. There's this little tidbit in my introduction to my book. I came to Washington in 1970 because Everett Dirksen had died a few months earlier. He had been the leader of the Senate Republicans. They shuffled the leadership, and a Colorado senator named Gordon Allett became chairman of the policy committee, and he said he wanted to hire a Republican academic to write for him. And then is now a Republican academic was kind of an oxymoron. But I Everett Dirksen interested me. He is from Central Illinois, as am I, and he was from Pekin, Illinois, which, for reasons no one quite knows, was named after Peking, China.
Oh.
And the high school sports teams were called the Pekin Chinks.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, gosh, indeed. a little tidbit that suggests that sensibilities have changed for the better. I just like things like that.
Funny. All right. Well, since you're going down memory lane and remembering when you first came to D.C., I will tell you a story about William F. Buckley, who we both knew, and a story about you, because one time Bill and I were talking and mentioning how much You know, Bill's favorite phrase was that he hated writing but loved having written, as many writers feel. And I was agreeing with that. And then we were talking about deadlines. And Bill, you know, in his inimitable fashion, he said, aren't deadlines liberating, right? Because you just know it's going to get done by X day and time when you have a deadline. So we agreed on that. And then Bill said, he got that, you know, sort of that puzzled look on his face. And he said, do you know that George Will enjoys the process of writing?
I do.
You mentioned
I love that. I love to write. It's a physical, tactile pleasure putting sentences together and sentences into paragraphs. I've never understood this, oh gosh, it's agony. The great sports columnist Red Smith was of the "Oh, it's agony" school. He said, "Writing, nothing to it. You just open a vein and bleed."
Yes.
I don't feel that. I don't understand that. If it's that awful, change jobs.
Right. Okay. Well, I wish I could have your cheerful approach. For me, it's more anxiety producing and so forth. But I too like the feeling of having written too much to give it up. So
when Scotty Reston was the bureau chief of the New York Times here in Washington and a regular columnist, he told me he had trouble sleeping the night before he knew he was going to have to write a column.
Wow, even after all those years?
All those years, yes.
That's amazing. People are endlessly interesting. Okay, well, I'm curious. So you've written at length in your last book and also in your columns about how you changed your mind about certain things over the last number of decades that you've been doing this. One of them was about the role of the courts. But I want to challenge your cheerfulness because you describe yourself that way in the introduction to this book. And, you can't imagine, you know, being happier with what you do for a living and so on, which is wonderful. But let me challenge it a little bit because, you know, there have been a number of essays and we talked about one of them last week on this podcast about the Donald Kagan essay. Which I'm sure you read, Robert Kagan, his son, Robert Kagan's essay about, you know, the dangers to the Republic. Our constitutional crisis is already here, he said. Elliot Cohn has something along the same lines in The Atlantic. These are not frivolous people, and they're deeply, deeply worried about the direction of things. Elliot quotes Yeats's famous line from The Second Coming, that in our time, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Do you have any of that sense?
Yes, I deeply resent the idea that I'm cheerful. I very much enjoy doing what I'm doing, but my stance toward current conditions in the immediate future is summed up in the phrase, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. I'm trying to be cheerful, but there's so much to be uncheerful about. We are a nation that is no longer educating elites that believe in the country, and it's an astonishing failure. And no nation is going to prosper when it has elites who think are faintly embarrassed by or feel they ought to be faintly embarrassed by the country's heritage. And with regard to what Robert Kagan and others have been writing about, it is simply astonishing that a large majority of one of our two major parties, the parties that have framed our political presidential competition since 1856, a large majority accept the broad contours of the argument that the last election was stolen. There being no evidence of this whatsoever, that doesn't matter. That's what makes this alarming.
So let's probe that a little further. The political party that you were associated with for many years that started over in neighboring Wisconsin, the Republican Party, chose in 2020 not to publish a platform at all. Simply to say, whatever the leader is for, that's what we're for. arguably, while the threat from the woke left and the closed-mindedness of the left, and as you say, the teaching, you know, teaching our young not to revere the country or love, in many instances, the country in which they were raised, you know, How do you respond to this argument? The people who are graduates of those institutions that are supposedly destroying the youth of tomorrow tend to be less willing to overturn the structures of American democracy than the party that is constantly proclaiming in the loudest possible fashion its deep patriotism.
Yes, it's a very strange situation in which the nature of patriotism itself is being contested. This was written about very well by Stephen Smith, a political philosopher at Yale, who says progressive patriotism is aspirational patriotism. It's patriotism, it's loyalty to and love of a country as it might come to be if people would just shape up and do what the progressives want. And on the right, people say, I love the country, but I don't like its universities, its media, its entertainment system. And pretty soon you're down to a sort of a rump America that they like. And this is why we have this very peculiar situation here where a nation founded on a good idea, the pursuit of happiness, is full of people whose happiness is exhausted by the unhappiness of the other tribe.
Right. Okay, let's bring in the rest of our crew here. Does anybody else want to weigh in on any of the things we've just discussed? If not, we can move on to our next topic.
Well, I mean, I would love to ask just a quick question of Mr. Will, if he's willing to entertain it. Yes, this is, it's great to get this book. I've been reading George since I was a wee tot. I think the first of his compilations of columns I received or bought was Suddenly, which I believe came out right as the Cold War was coming to an end. And I've been reading them ever since and learning ever since about how to be a columnist and to do it well. The one question I had, which I know George Will has very strong views of, is the place of the man Donald Trump in this book. This is a compilation of columns from 2008 to 2020. Donald Trump was president for four of those years. And if you go to the index of this book, you will find a very scant number of pages devoted to this man, who seems to be so much kind of at the center of the maelstrom of what we've already been talking about. Why is that? What I assume you, I mean, I've been reading you in the Post through the Trump years, and you did write about him more than one would expect from looking at that index. So that means that you made a choice not to reproduce all that many columns that were devoted to him and his antics for those 4 years or 5 years, if you count the year before he actually became president. So I'm just curious why that decision.
Yeah, my friends at the Post editorial page used to nag me a bit to write more about Trump, because when I did, I was so scalding it lit up their scoreboard. And they actually have a scoreboard where they can see in real time the readership traffic toward one story or another. The problem is, I explained to them, is he's boring. First of all, there was hardly a scarcity of writings about Trump. Trump, for both liberals and Trumpians, he played the role of God. That is, he explained absolutely everything. Whereas, in fact, he's an open book who's been reading himself to the country for 30 years. He has changed nothing in his repertoire. Except he now substitutes China for what he used to speak about Japan as the next coming superpower. He has one pedal on the organ. He's worked it forever, and he's not interesting to me. And that's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons I'm vaguely cheerful about 2024, is I do think that when an entertainer becomes a bore, he's in deep trouble, and he is fundamentally and always an entertainer. I'm a lapsed political philosopher. I've trained for that and briefly taught political philosophy. And when I write columns, I try to locate the subject of the column in close proximity to some principle of lasting interest, which is why I think I can get away with collecting columns, because I think that people come back and say, yeah, I see the relevance here. And Trump is not that interesting. Populism is interesting. Demagoguery is interesting. But do we have to illustrate everything with regard to that man?
Okay. Linda.
Well, as I was in Colorado the last few weeks, and I remember Gordon Allott very well, by the way, George, yeah. He was a senator from the state that I grew up in. But as I was there, I visited with some friends who are not particularly political people, but one thing they are is fervent Trumpists. And it was a very interesting time I had discussing things with them. And I realized that what seems to motivate a lot of people on the Trumpist right is not that they are in favor of something, not even that they have any personal regard for Donald Trump. What motivates them is what they are against. And it seems to me that if you scratch just the surface, you find that there is a lot of enmity on the right to what they consider the liberal elites, the news media, and all of the policies that those elites have been promoting for years, including something that I very much believe in, and that is immigration reform. So that, you know, I was just shocked at this woman who was my friend and who's very mild-mannered and very cultured and a very pleasant woman. When she started talking about the January 6th riot, the amount of venom that sort of was spewing out of her mouth, her husband had to finally interrupt her. And so I wanted to ask you whether or not you think I became a conservative in the world of the Cold War, and what motivated me to vote for Ronald Reagan, the first Republican I ever voted for, was my belief that only Ronald Reagan could be a challenge to the Soviet Union. Well, you know, the Soviet Union disappeared, some of the motivating factor around the conservative movement, I think, got very wishy-washy after that. And now we have this, I think, just universal rage at the left and what they have done culturally to our institutions, what they feel about the country, as you rightly said, that they do not have a love of the country that is only an aspirational patriotism that looks to change everything about the country that we have now. Do you think that that is something that can be sustained? And how do we get ourselves out of that? How do we get back to being motivated by something we believe in instead of being motivated by that which we hate?
George, before you answer, can I just quickly jump in and say that Linda, to summarize Linda's point, it seems that they really hate liberals more than they hated communists.
Yes. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Well, what Linda's talking about, if I could cast it just slightly differently, I have trouble understanding how one could write legislation. Leave aside immigration, that I understand, but how you can write legislation that would assuage their grievances. In the 19th century, we argued about things that eventually got put into law or taken out of law. Fugitive slave law, how to fund the government with land sales or tariffs, should slavery be taken into the territories, and if so, how do you decide this? There were things you could say, there's legislation out there, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, the Compromise of 1850. How do you write legislation to assuage grievances that have a lot to do with status and to have a lot to do with the fact that an enormous number of people on the right feel condescended to and despised by people on the left? If you can't write legislation, it's somehow not quite political. And a political party, therefore, organized around this kind of performative grievances is not a political party anymore. It's something else. Am I making any sense? I mean, do you hear what I'm saying? Someone said, some of the people you're talking to in Colorado, again, immigration is a policy issue. Good, we can talk about that and write laws. But a lot of what's bothering them, the media and the rest, you can't say, good, there ought to be a law and we'll write the law. How do you deal with this? It's cultural resentments are sort of above or below or something. It's outside of politics.
Yeah, well, this is Mona again. One of the issues that most energizes the right, from what I can understand these days, is critical race theory. And there are moves to ban its teaching. Now, that's legislation. Now, of course, it's way overbroad, poorly defined, arguably unconstitutional. But that might be the kind of legislation they have in mind.
It's also the sort of thing that ought to be done at the school board level in Douglas County, Colorado, and other places, as Linda will attest, that Colorado has been ground zero for very local actions about schools. Again, the last thing we want is, God save us, Congress, or for that matter, even state legislatures getting involved. When state legislatures decide to take up primary and secondary school curricula, the results are not good, and you wind up in Dayton, Tennessee.
Right. Bill Galston.
Yeah. George, I note with interest that your one direct quotation so far in this discussion was from a cultural Marxist, Antonio Gramsci.
That's right.
But moving right along, since I've continued to ply the trade that you fled for greener pastures, I do have a question that I've been wanting to ask you for a very long time. One of your earliest and best-known books was a volume called Statecraft as Soulcraft. I have a feeling that since you wrote that book, you've become less enthusiastic about the soul crafting business, at least as a concern of the state. If that is correct, could you describe for us and our vast listening audience what led you to change your mind?
I don't quite think, Bill, that I've really changed my mind. Let me tell you how I've evolved, how I've grown, as the politicians say. Statecraft is Soulcraft, and I can't tell you the permutations of the title that I heard when I was traveling to promote that book. Who we have here today on Eyewitness Dayton or on Good Morning Pittsburgh, George Will, the author of Stagecoach as Stagecraft. Anyway, I gave the Godkin lectures at Harvard, and these lectures became this book, in which I argued that the subtitle of the book was Statecraft is Soulcraft, What Government Does, meaning what government cannot help but do by sustaining a kind of economy and by sustaining a regime of certain practices. It shapes its citizens, can't do otherwise, so we ought to think about it. That was really the essence of my argument in Statecraft is Soulcraft. Bill, that was I gave those lectures in 1981, and since then I've spent 40 more years in Washington and have acquired a deeper reservoir of skepticism about the ability of modern government to act constructively, particularly on matters like this. I said in Statecraft to Soulcraft, the classic example of Soulcraft is the public accommodation section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, when we said as a country, A, we're going to stop insulting people in public in front of their children by turning them away from restaurants. And we're going to make people swim together and go to school together because it's good for their souls. It will change the way they think. And you know what? It worked. It worked resoundingly. So that was Soulcraft. But I haven't abandoned that. I would take back nothing I said about the Civil Rights Act. What I now say, and it's developed at great length in a chapter in my book, The Conservative Sensibility, is that capitalism itself, a market economy, is soulcraft. A market economy makes for a polite and cooperative society, and cooperative people, and polite people. To take a minor example, you walk into an American shop, the first words you hear are, how may I help you? a market society is a society of spontaneous order among cooperating individuals. So I'm a bit more libertarianish than I used to be, partly because of, I won't say despair, but increased skepticism about the central government. But I'm still take entirely seriously the fact that the nature of the regime has an impress on the souls of those who live under the regime, and I worry about exactly the same stuff with some new conclusions.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although I would point out that the market economy, which we still have, has not done quite as good a job of civilizing us in recent decades as it once might have.
I agree with that.
Deeper thought.
Yeah, I would agree to that. But I would not say that the market economy is making us uncivilized. I would say the market economy, for all its civilizing effects, those effects cannot combat autonomous cultural coarsenings that have not to do with the economy.
Which brings us to our next topic, perfectly actually, because we're going to discuss Facebook, which is a product of the free market that many people believe is coarsening and possibly poisoning our culture. This week we had a Facebook outage. It was down for something like 5 hours. Our own Damon Linker wrote a column about how, you know, the millennium had arrived for those 5 hours. Wasn't it wonderful? But Facebook is also now facing a whistleblower who is saying, you know, has left the company and brought a big trove of documents showing that Facebook is perfectly aware that it's platforms exacerbate depression and eating disorders and anxiety among teenagers, for example, but that they choose to permit that to happen rather than to behave responsibly in the name of profit. So let me start with you, Damon, since you wrote about this. You said, we have to wonder whether Facebook is a useful entity that just has externalities like pollution, and therefore we should just regulate it, or whether it's more like a criminal enterprise, in which case you just outlaw it. So those were the two choices that you gave. I'm not saying necessarily those are the only two, but care to elaborate?
Yeah, I mean, my point was simply that, and in general, I agree. I think I plugged something that Clarence Thomas wrote in a decision a few months ago that kind of gestured in this direction, I think a little sloppily, but in an interesting way, that we don't have adequate law and even thinking about these technology companies, the social media companies, because it's not clear what category to put them in. And so it's not clear whether if we're going to regulate them, do we regulate them along the lines of a utility or along the lines of a public accommodation. When it comes to free speech, that's a little unclear. And then for the purposes of the discussion about Facebook, is the problem as we see them, like, for instance, the whistleblower's testimony in Congress, I believe on Tuesday of this week, focused on the question of how Facebook is very much aware that it is an extremely effective medium for the dissemination of misinformation, and that is very detrimental to the functioning life of a democracy. And they also know that another of their holdings, Instagram, has a negative impact on teenagers and especially teenage girls' emotional well-being by encouraging them to share often doctored photographs of themselves in a kind of clamorous pursuit of likes and positive comments and so forth. So the question we have before us is, okay, well, if these are bad consequences that are somehow harming American life, Do we regulate them in the way that we would regulate an enterprise that provided a positive product or function or service, but that had negative externalities like, say, pollution, something that as a byproduct of this positive thing that we want, it needs to be controlled. So we could tax the negative externality, we could outlaw it and make them change something about their business practice to limit it in some way and set standards. But that's an open question, because then the question becomes, actually, is Facebook, is Instagram actually something that produces the negative effect as a very consequence of the business practice itself? So more like, if you're a heroin dealer, is the problem with heroin that the people who use your product are just doing it irresponsibly? Well, no, maybe the very fact of taking it is irresponsible. And if that's the case, then we face the kind of thing that we confront with hard drugs, which we try to prohibit rather than simply regulate, at least in the non-libertarian utopia, we do that. And George Will back in the day used to write very cogent arguments about gambling and how gambling needed to remain outlawed for the same kind of consideration, that it's not just that some people who gamble, it's bad for them or it contributes to negative effects in society, but the very act of inculcating people into a gambling lifestyle, as we might say today, is just bad for them and bad for society intrinsically. And these are questions I don't really answer in the column, because I think we haven't answered them as a society, and they're really hard, because there is a way in which the business practices of social media companies who make their money by attempting to harvest information about our preferences and then shaping our preferences in order to more effectively sell advertising, is in a way potentially in a different category of enterprise, period. So we have a lot of work to do in doing that kind of first order thinking about even defining what it is these companies are. And only once we've done that can we figure out, well, do we just let them do what they do, or do we need to jump in and attempt to control them a little more differently than we have so far, which is as pretty much with nothing at all. It's been pretty much free reign so far.
George, 36% of Americans, at last count, it's probably gone up since then, regularly get their news from Facebook. So they're getting their news from a source that is completely unregulated, in the sense that, you know, there are no editors, there are no people making decisions they're responsible for mm-hmm. about the truth or falsity of what goes out over Facebook. Furthermore, Facebook has algorithms that specifically move people based on their preferences toward more and more radical and extreme information. So the company in the person of Mark Zuckerberg has been begging for federal regulation for some time now. And some people are suspicious about that. They say, well, yeah, he of course wants to be regulated because he's, you know, got $1 trillion, but his competitors will be harmed and he'll be benefited. So what is your sense of all this?
My sense is, first of all, that regulating Facebook will help entrench Facebook, whereas if left to its own natural course, is apt to go the way of the Roman, Carolingian, Ottoman, Habsburg, British, and Roman empires. Why do we assume that Facebook is forever? Again, these other empires weren't. Second, I hear an echo here of earlier moral panics, comic books, video games, etc., but particularly in the 1950s, when we went from 1950 with essentially no televisions to 1960, everyone was watching television, there was a great moral panic about the power of advertising. John Kenneth Galbraith wrote a supremely silly book called The Affluent Society, in which he said the law of supply and demand is now obviated because manufacturers can manufacture whatever demand they find it convenient to satisfy, such as the power of advertising. His book came out just as the might of merchandising might of the Ford Motor Company was put behind the Edsel, which proved to be inadequate. I think Facebook may be a little bit like cigarettes, but not entirely. Cigarettes are inherently and always harmful when used as intended. Mm-hmm. Facebook is not like that. Now, I'm not the right guy to talk about this because I've never seen Facebook, literally. I'm told I have a Facebook page. I've never seen it. I'm just not interested. But it seems to me, before we turn to the government, maybe we ought to turn to parents who are sitting around the table and they could talk to, and heaven forbid, actually have rules that they enforce with their children regarding the use of these screens. Because if it isn't done by parents, it is not going to be done well. It might not be done well by parents, but it will only be done well by parents.
Linda, one of the proposals that's out there is that such regulation as will exist would simply require Facebook and its competitors to empower parents by making it easy. Of course, you know, the kids are going to know how to use these platforms better than their parents. So it would be required that the platforms make it, you know, sort of parent friendly in a way that, and by the way, people use it on their phones even more than on their laptops or whatever. So yeah, it would have to be something where the parents could control it. What do you think about that? Is that adequate or what's your view?
Well, I'm not quite as much of an old fuddy-duddy as George Will. I have actually seen Facebook. I have a Facebook page, but I never use it. So I'm not the best person to talk about this, but I will say that I think Bill is absolutely George is absolutely on to something when he talks about it being the parents' role. The problem is that the parents are also on Facebook and the grandparents are on Facebook. I don't know how you go about regulating an enterprise that is as omnipresent as Facebook is in American culture today. And what you're really talking about is not so much the content that is on there as it is the way in which the company is driving the participants to pages and information based on algorithms, which, you know, according to the whistleblower this last week, essentially try to encourage anger, try to encourage hate in some cases. And that to me seems more the problem than anything. And whether or not there would be a way to regulate the company from using these kinds of algorithms, I mean, again, I think George's point about advertising is correct. I mean, what these platforms are is really a vehicle for delivering advertisements to the people who are on them. That is their business model. They want to ensure clicks. They want to ensure people, you know, to go to sites that will gain, you know, revenue as a result of being directed there. They want to sell products. And they use personal information about the participants and their habits in order to skew people in that direction. So if there's ever going to be any kind of regulation, it seems it would have to be in the nature of how much Facebook as an entity can basically spy on us and know what pages we're reading in newspapers, know what publications we read, know enough about us to be able to skew us in these very destructive ways. But I think George also has a point that Facebook may not be around forever. And, you know, I don't know how you, I really don't know how you stop this kind of thing. Maybe one of the other people on the panel does, but I have to admit, I don't.
So one wise Silicon Valley head once said, if a product is free, you are the product. And 75% of Facebook users, according to another poll, did not know that Facebook compiles information on their tastes and other demographic factors about them, which is kind of interesting. But Bill, I'll come to you on this. You know, one of the worries that people express is, look, these algorithms, because Facebook makes its money, they call it the attention economy, but I don't really think that's any different from other forms of advertising. But in any event, they want to keep your eyeballs on their screen. Mm-hmm. And they have found that the best way to keep people's eyeballs is to make them angry or upset. And their algorithms gear people toward that. So they use the example of a 13-year-old girl who goes on to Facebook and searches for things about healthy eating. And it's really a very short trip they've shown from looking for healthy eating recommendations to getting to sites that promote anorexia as a fashion thing. So that is the kind of twisting of people's interests and distorting of their desires that people worry social media is particularly pernicious in doing.
Well, Mona, you've hit on exactly the point that I wanted to emphasize. This is terra incognita for a lot of us, particularly those of us of, shall we say, the older persuasion. And I've been hunting around for metaphors, analogies that can begin to frame my confusion and uncertainty. In the early days of Facebook, the prevailing image was of a huge virtual Hyde Park where anybody could enter, anybody could speak, anybody could listen. And as you wandered around in this Hyde Park, you would hear somebody saying something interesting or provocative, something you agree with. You tarry to listen. And perhaps when it's time for the question period, you pose a question, you talk back, etc. It's hard to get upset about that, even though there may be some externalities that we need to attend to. But suppose that's not exactly the right picture. Suppose there's someone at the gateway or nearby who is saying, in effect, I understand that you don't like black people or Jews. Did you know that there are groups right over there of other people who don't like black people? Maybe you want to go there and hear some more about their reasons for not liking black people. And so it is not the market exactly that's doing this sorting. It is a form of social engineering being carried out for profit-making purposes by Facebook. Query, is there something actionable in that act? Is every form of legislation to regulate that form of social engineering per se unconstitutional or illegitimate? I am not sure that the answer to that question is no. And I would be a lot happier if we didn't have one of the world's largest corporations directing individuals into echo chambers, which demonstrably make the opinions that you enter with even more intense and less rational over time than they were at the beginning. So I think there is real food for thought here, and I hope an opportunity for action.
Yeah, Bill, I just want to say plus one to that because, you know, it does present one possible explanation for the explosion of craziness and nonsense that we see in American life now, where an entire, you know, group of the Republican Party, a big portion of the Republican mm-hmm. Party believes things that are manifestly false. This was not the case a few years ago. So something has changed about the information environment and the emotional environment that has been created. And some of that is, you know, cable news and people self-sorting into their silos, but some of it is, I think, almost certainly social media as well.
I will say also, Mona, just to tweak George a little bit, it is perfectly true that Facebook may not be forever, almost certainly won't be. It is equally true, going back to his litany of vanished empires, that American democracy probably won't be forever either. And I would much rather hasten the demise of Facebook than the demise of American democracy.
I like to think that's the fallacy of the false alternative. I really do believe we're treading awfully close to the most dangerous thing in the last 150 years of world politics, and that is the denial of human agency. All the great wickednesses of the 20th century were related to people who thought that other human beings could be socially engineered or directed, to use two words that we've just used on this podcast. Again, I want to go back to the advertising sphere that produced Vance Packard's book, The Hidden Persuaders, that Americans were constantly being manipulated because this fabulous merchandising device, a television set, suddenly appeared in all American living rooms. We should be very careful not to talk about the Facebook users as passive lumps or as atoms that are shoved around by these forces. Once you start talking about people like that, you're halfway to making people like that, to making them feel as though their agency is gone and their responsibility is gone. It just seems to me that Facebook doesn't have that power unless people semi-choose to go with the flow and to be drifted along like corks bobbing on a stream. So when we talk about Facebook directing people here and there and engineering society, we begin to talk about human beings as malleable raw material. And all the great horrors in politics in the last 150 years or so have been related to exactly that premise, that people are indeed lumps of matter that can be shaped. I just don't think it's true.
Okay, let me just quickly respond to that, because the great villains of the 20th century thought that humans were infinitely malleable. That's right. They were going to make a new Soviet man and all of that. But their goal was to be the manipulators. Here, people are saying, how can we limit the power of the manipulators in some fashion? So it's a little different emphasis, I would suggest.
Yes, but the manipulators who were going to make new Soviet man had the Lubyanka prison and the cells down there where they shot people and they had torture chambers. Zuckerberg doesn't have that kind of coercive power. He just right.
Well,
doesn't.
He is a synecdoche. I mean, we're talking about all of social media here. I mean, you know, but
all together, they don't have that kind of power.
Right. Well, they may be pushing in a direction, though, that is extremely unhealthy and worrisome. And I don't know. Saying that we might want to ask them to tweak their algorithms so that they don't push people toward the extremes. Doesn't seem to me to be social engineering on a vast scale, but
you're not really contemplating just asking them. You're talking mm-hmm. about a legal regime that would coerce them to quit coercing us. And
yes.
My goodness, what a downward spiral.
Okay, well, there we are. Let us move on to our third and final topic. We are running long, so we're going to have very little time for a huge subject. But let me start with you, Bill Galston. The old wisdom was you shouldn't try to enact big policy changes on the backs of slim majorities. This Congress is attempting to do exactly that. And I guess one could say, you know, maybe the Affordable Care Act is the counterexample. They passed the Affordable Care Act by a very slim margin, though they did have much bigger majority in the House and Senate than they have now. But it was they had to do all kinds of ledger domain to get it passed, and it wasn't initially popular, and they lost the House. But in time, it was popular. It was popular to the point where when Republicans finally achieved their majorities and were able to make good on their 10-year-old promises to repeal and replace it, they didn't. Do you think that's a good bargain for them?
I really can't predict the future. I can't predict the consequences of major acts that produce legal acts that produce discontinuities. To give you one pertinent example, some social issues move strongly in one direction, like same-sex marriage, or with a lag, interracial marriage, which enjoyed the support of 5% of the American population in the 1940s, and the latest reading is 94%. I will say this. I think that the president and the Democrats are overreading the meaning of the 2020 election pretty significantly. They are likely to pay a price for that, at least in the short term. I do believe that setting aside the process and looking at the substance, there is much to be said for a child allowance that is directed towards working class and even some middle class Americans, though not everybody. And I think there is something to be said for modified versions of much of what is contained in the reconciliation bill. But I do think there is wisdom to the old maxim that if you are making great changes on slender majorities, you are likely to pay a price. And one of the prices, as we've seen, is that close to half the country will not even consider accepting what you have done over their heads, and will try to reverse it as soon as they have the power to do so, leading to policy instability, years of wasted thought, wasted energy, wasted passion over issues that could have been resolved more consensually. So if you ask me, should these sorts of changes be done without the kind of process that produced 69 votes in the Senate of the United States for the infrastructure bill that's now languishing in the House? The answer is preferably no.
George, are Democrats attempting to enact a European-style welfare state, in addition to maintaining America's disproportionate spending on the military, and without the middle-class taxes that European countries pay for their welfare states with?
Precisely. They want half of the European recipe. It's the value-added tax that they're going to leave out. And this is what's such a telltale symptom of the current Democratic problem. Joe Biden says the country wants this stuff. Well, I know free stuff polls well. That's not a news bulletin. But what he simultaneously says is, by the way, 98.2% of the American people, those of you earning less than $400,000 a year, aren't going to pay a nickel for this. Well, of course, it pays really well then, polls really well then. So it would be much more convincing if he said, you want it, and therefore we're going to help you buy it. Instead, he's saying we're going to tax two unpopular entities, the rich and corporations. So there's a deeply deceptive sleight of hand going on here. When they come out and say, we have the courage of our convictions, we're going to have a value-added tax for these broad-based benefits, then I'll begin to believe them. It's a little bit analogous to people who say the world is coming to an end because of global warming, but we're opposed to nuclear power. Come on. I just want people to get their ends and means together.
Damon, taxing corporations is always very popular. Make those rich corporations pay the bill. But, you know, Republicans, I used to like the old-fashioned Republicans, people like Mitt Romney, who would say, you know, actually, corporations don't pay taxes. Corporations pass along the expense to their consumers in the form of they either hire fewer people or they raise their prices or they do something, right? I mean, it's not going to come out of the pockets of wealthy CEOs. That reality has not been repealed, has it, Damon?
No, it hasn't. Although I hope you won't mind if I don't really jump on the corporate tax part of this huge gargantuan pair of bills, just because it's not the thing I feel most passionately about.
Well, and, I don't either. And, I'm just saying it's not honest.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Although it's also true that even the Biden plan wouldn't raise corporate taxes up to where they were for quite a long time before Trump lowered them. So we're kind of dickering over a few percentage points. And that's, again, from my point of view, not the biggest problem. I would be fine to support somewhat higher corporate taxes against the Trump baseline if it were combined with tax hikes in other areas to pay for the raft of spending that Biden and his party is proposing right now. Although it's all very murky. I mean, none of this has been settled. We have what Biden proposed. We have progressives who want one thing and moderates who want something else. And everything is sort of up for grabs right now. So we don't really know how it will end up unfolding. I mean, I'm actually more alarmed by what the consequences are for Joe Biden's popularity from this mess that he's gotten himself into here. Now, it's not just this bill and how long it's taking and the messy process. It's also the way the Afghanistan withdrawal unfolded. It's also the fact that Biden announced on July 4th that he was declaring independence from the COVID-19 pandemic, and it obviously didn't go away. We had the Delta surge, and now we're just not sure what's coming in the winter. But whatever this mix of things, Biden's popularity is on a downward slide, and it isn't stopping. I hoped about a month ago that maybe he'd find a new floor around 45-46% approval, but he's now down around 44. And there was a Quinnipiac poll yesterday on Wednesday, came out this week, that was really just brutal, like on a series of issue areas as well as personal traits. He is underwater. They range from close to even on handling the pandemic to all the way down to on immigration. 25% approve, 67 disapprove. Situation on the Mexican border, 23 approve, 67 disapprove. And the all-important, more than half of Americans, which is 55%, now say the Biden administration is not competent in running the government. That is bad. And is it going to be reversed when finally we get a bill or two bills out of this and they get passed? I'm not so sure about that either, given the fact that another poll from Politico and Morning, what's that called?
The Morning Consult.
Yeah, Morning Consult poll this week also showed that, most Americans don't even credit Biden for the $300 per child check that we're getting every month.
They credit the Democrats, though.
They barely, 52%, I believe, credited the Democrats, and it was 38% for Biden. That's basically saying Democrats credit the Democrats for that. I mean, that doesn't seem to produce much confidence on my part that as soon as we get a bill passed, everyone's going to stand up and applaud. So this is really risky business. business that Biden is dealing with, and given the threat of a Trump run again in 2024, the idea that Biden has gotten himself into this fix, it makes me pretty nervous. So I could be happier at the moment.
Right. So Linda, Damon's nervous because the alternative is the orange Mar-a-Lago man who's, you know, preparing to run his revenge race. Now, when you look at 2024 and you consider what will be important to voters, I would submit to you that the following things are possibilities: the state of the economy, the state of the pandemic, inflation, the situation at the border, the crime rate, and possibly these huge bills that the Democrats have been spending all of their attention on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, here we have a reconciliation bill that is 2,465 pages long that has dramatic changes in entitlements, granting new entitlements. Senator Manchin has been given a great deal of grief by the left for having talked about this as, you know, leading us into a more of an entitlement state. But it is that. And the fact is that normally when you have these big kinds of changes, certainly when you had Medicare, when you had the civil rights laws, you had months of hearings and debates. You had floor debates in the House and the Senate. You gave the American people time to be able to digest what was being proposed, to decide whether they liked it or didn't like it. You had lawmakers able to think through very carefully what the effects of the legislation were going to be. And here you have none of that. And this has been the pattern, I think, since Obama and Obamacare. I've said on this program before that I've changed my mind about whether or not some sort of national health program was a good idea or a bad idea. I now think it was a good idea, but I do not think the way it came to be was the right method to achieve it. And I think you're going to see the same thing here. So it's not a surprise that the American people are going to be thinking about things other than what's in this grand reconciliation bill. They haven't really heard very much about what's in it, and they certainly haven't had time to think through its implications. And that's really the big problem today, I think, in Congress, is that they spend all too much time bickering over the price tag of bills that they haven't even fully vetted and considered. And this is just not the way to run a democracy, in my view. I think that, you know, we really, when you're talking about big changes, whether on climate or childcare or entitlements for the elderly, that these are things that have to be thought through. And we've had none of that. And so, of course, Biden's not going to get any credit for it. And the bigger picture, exactly what you described, is going to be the issue that's going to determine the election in 2024. And the way it's looking right now, I don't see anybody able to challenge Donald Trump in the Republican Party. And I'm not altogether confident that if we have a Donald Trump versus Joe Biden presidential election in 2024, that the outcome will be the same as it was last time.
Okay, Linda, I've caught you out. Earlier, you said you were not a fuddy-duddy, but you are. You're saying you think things should be thought through and considered.
No, I said I wasn't as much of a fuddy-duddy as George Will. That's a slight qualification.
All right. Well, look, I will just add one thing, which is I do think that agreeing with everything you said, but one of the reasons we find ourselves in this position is the abuse of the filibuster. When the filibuster became a tool for absolutely everything, demanding that everything had to pass by a supermajority, the party that had a majority, if they didn't have a two-thirds majority or a 60-vote majority, rather, is kind of forced to throw everything that they want to achieve into these huge bills that they can pass on reconciliation without having to endure a filibuster. So that is, I think, part of part of the mess is the overuse of the filibuster. And by the way, this week, Mitch McConnell, because he was apparently frightened of moves and talk among in the Democratic caucus of possibly ending the filibuster in order to deal with the debt limit, caved on that issue and said he would not filibuster an attempt to raise the debt ceiling temporarily, only until December, but at least we're no longer, I think while we were speaking today, they probably raised it so that at least for a couple more months, we don't have to worry about defaulting. All right, we now come to our final segment. I'm very sorry we've run long. So let us get to our highlights and lowlights of the week. Bill Galston.
This will be simple, Mona. I'll make it fast. My highlight of the week was receiving and reading George Will's latest book. There are 192, if my count is correct, entries in the book. And so I asked myself at the end of this cheerful process, what was my favorite item? I narrowed it down to two. The second place finisher was an item I can commend to all under the title of Aristotle and the Bikini-Clad Baristas. I will leave it to your imagination how that particular one spun out. But my favorite was an item called Baseball's Common Law. Like George, I am a white male of a certain age and therefore, or this is almost a syllogism, a baseball fan. His distinction between the laws of baseball and the common law of baseball, otherwise the norms of baseball, maps very neatly onto contemporary discussions of the ills of our constitutional democracy, where what is not written but was once enforceable is now both unwritten and unenforceable, to the great detriment of everybody. One line from this essay must suffice. When a reporter asked Gaylord Perry's 5-year-old daughter if her father threw a spitball, she replied, quote, "It's a hard slider." Now, that is formative parental education for you.
Okay, thank you. Damon Linker.
Okay, this is a little less lighthearted than that. This firmly goes in the category of low light of the week. Put it in the folder marked what conservatism has become, at least intellectual conservatism has become in 2021 America. I haven't been a fan of the guy in quite a long time, but Roger Kimball is a very, very respected name on the right in this country, the editor and now publisher of the New Criterion, which used to be a pretty impressive cultural periodical. He's drifted over to the Trumpian side of things over the last 5 years, and he's recently contributed a talk that has now been published with Hillsdale College, which is also has a very storied history among conservatives, a small college in Michigan that is very skewed toward conservatism in its education, and has done a good job of educating young conservatives for a long time. But Kimball gave this talk there in September. It's now been published in Hillsdale's online magazine, Imprimis, which apparently reaches about 6 million people or has 6 million subscribers, no less. This is titled The January 6th Insurrection Hoax. And I will merely read a couple of sentences from it. It was hard to pick out a passage, but I'll choose this one. As the years go by, historians, if the censors allow them access to the documents and give them leave to publish their findings, may well count the 2016 presidential election as the last fair and open democratic election in U.S. history. I know we are not supposed to say that. I know that the heads of Twitter and Facebook and other woke guardians of the status quo call this the big lie and do all they can to suppress it. But every honest person knows that the 2020 election was tainted. So there you go. Roger Kimball's onward descent into the mire continues.
Thank you, Damon. Taking nothing away from your point, I would just like to state that that 6 million figure for subscribers is dubious. I used to receive imprimis for years, never paid for it once. So they have some other system other than paid subscribers.
I'm not surprised.
Okay, Linda Chavez.
Well, I'll just add to that, Mona, that I get three copies of imprimis whenever it's put out. So, and I've never subscribed either. So that was a real downer from Damon. I want to give a highlight, and I'll tell you the highlight of my week is being on the same program as George Will, somebody I have very long admired. And I will say that he has elevated the whole tone of this discussion. Mona, I don't ever remember a podcast in which the words synecdoche and leisure domain were used in less than 1 hour on the podcast. So I credit George Will for having elevated that. Yes. His comment also about agency really fits in well with the piece that I want to point out. This is not a new piece. It was written back on May 10th, and it's in Substack, and it's by John McWhorter. And he says, can we please ditch the term systemic racism? He says, as a linguist, I know we can't, but systemic racial inequalities can almost never be undone by getting rid of the racism. And I think what it really points to, and this is the point with the notion about agency, one of the biggest problems in my view is that when you talk about systemic racism, what you do is take away the agency of those racist and racist actions that actually do take place. And I think that's a travesty. So I recommend this piece by John McWhorter. I think he does a very nice job of talking about what some of the problems are with even the term systemic racism, which means very little.
John McWhorter, if you're listening, we still the invitation to come on this podcast and be our guest is still outstanding. George Will.
Highlight of the week, I'll be really brief. The highlight of the week for me was reading Alan C. Guelza's new biography of Robert E. Lee. It's a cool, dry-eyed assessment of someone who lived in situations he did not particularly like and did not choose and acted in ways that he thought were honorable. And Guelza says, not really. It also demonstrates that Robert E. Lee was extremely boring. He never seems to have had an interesting thought that he either wrote down or suggested to someone. I mean, he's an all-time overrated figure. Anyway, the low light of the week is another development in the English language. The Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, and there actually is such a thing, has said it's not good enough to call a woman a birthing person. Their phrase is human milk feeding individual.
Oh,
so add that to your, that's my low light.
Yes. Oh yes. That is even worse than pregnant people, which has been bothering me for some time. Oh, all right. Well, my highlight is from Noah Smith, who is available on Substack on his column called No Opinion. And it's called Nuclear or Solar. And as a longtime fan of nuclear power as a solution to climate woes, I was interested to see that in this piece that Smith talks about the dramatic progress that has been made in solar technology and batteries. The price drop in the cost of producing and distributing and so on, solar modules has been, from 1976 to 2019, is dropped in cost by a factor of 250. And over the last 10 years, the price of solar-powered electricity has dropped by 89%, also very significant. And also, apparently, we are developing all kinds of new batteries that will help to store solar power. It isn't the complete solution to fossil fuel dependence, but it is a huge step in the right direction. And I want to emphasize one more time, I now know that there's a name for what I am, which is a techno-optimist. That is, you can be as realist as you like about human nature and about tribalism and about all the various flaws that human beings have. But when it comes to technology, we are an amazing species. And you don't really need to go very far other than No Opinion on Substack to get copious evidence of this. And it is encouraging. With that, I want to thank the great George Will for joining us again. I recommend his book, American Happiness and Discontents. And thank you all for your fantastic letters and also for your fantastic ratings on iTunes. This week I went and checked out some of them. Wow. I mean, it almost brought tears to my eyes. Thank you so much. And we are so appreciative, and keep it up. And we will return next week as every week.